Good morning. Good morning, everybody. How did you sleep? I woke up at 3 and then I had to go sleep again. And I almost overslept. I don't know, my son was walking up and about doing his school stuff. What brings us together today, before we get there, maybe let's just get to the issue first. What brings us today together is a petition that was brought to Parliament on 12th of August 2012, if my facts are correct. This is after parliamentary process went through of consultation that came through until March 2012, if my facts are correct. To an extent, the petition's main objects will have to be explained as to what is it that it seeks to achieve. Being Parliament and also being a platform for dialogue, representation of people out there, it is also allowed that you can bring, because through those dialogues, people lobby. It's allowed. Lobbying is allowed. It is allowed, and it happens in South Africa in a very open fashion. I'm quite conscious as well that there are other lobbies that take place behind the doors. In other words, outside of a public platform. This one is happening openly. It seeks to achieve the objectives that you are going to be outlining. As a result of that, we have also allowed a team from biotech industry, our old friend of Parliament, veteran Mr. Lombard, is going to introduce that team. And all of us together, we're expecting to pull together our presentations and responses in 1 hour. In other words, we've got to be quite economical, to the point. Very little, if you can, background. More to the issues. Boom. So that we assist each other. Before we get to the issues themselves and allowing African Center for Biodiversity to come through, we certainly do have apologies from the Director General who cannot make it. They are busy with MINTEC meeting and also head of department forum in Durban. And then also Mr. Gaylor, he has taken leave until the 28th of February. And Mrs. Twala, she's on work related in Northern Cape until the 3rd of March. And also Mr. Abram cannot make it today because he has fallen ill. Mr. Cele is attending another committee on correctional services. So is Mrs. Paliso. These are the only apologies that we do have. Without waste of time, this becomes a briefing session by the two groups, and the floor is yours. I take it we have Mrs. Swenby. Thank you. The floor is yours, madam.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you this morning. I'd like to also put forward apologies for our director, Mary Mayette. She would love to have been here today, but unfortunately, myself and her are flying to Ghana this afternoon, and she couldn't be with us. So I also need to leave at 11:15. I hope that will be fine with you, to rush and catch a plane. And my colleague Gareth Jones is with me to fill in the gaps when I leave. And he's also done a lot of the research on the pesticides, so he's also going to present a bit on the pesticides and assist me with any questions. So just a little bit about the African Center for Biosafety. We've been playing a watchdog role for the past decade in South Africa. So we've been interacting with the GMO policy. We've been watching the permits as they've been applied for. We've put in about 50 objections in the past 10 years, which means that we've applied for the scientific dossiers, we've analyzed them, we've given them to experts in their field for their expert opinion, and brought independent science to our regulators. We've also, we're very, very much part of a large African network of social movements and farmer leaders, and we've assisted other African organizations to do assessments of their biosafety laws, and our work is very much informed by this network that we work with. This petition that we've brought, as we heard, was brought in 2012, and we were supported by Ms. Sherilyn Dudley of the ACDP. And the petition that we brought was against a decision by our regulators to allow a commodity import of genetically modified maize, which is resistant to a chemical called 2,4-D, and I'll explain some of our concerns around that now. The petition was signed by 18 health professionals, and we consulted very heavily with experts in their field, and they really assisted us with a lot of the science. So just to give you some idea of the people who supported us both in the research and put their signature to the petition. I've put down a few of them here. For example, Prof. Leslie London from the Center of Occupational and Environmental Health Research at UCT. Prof. Myers, who's the director of the same institution. Dr. Delvey, who's the program leader of chemical exposures and toxicity. Professor Baldwin Raghavan, who heads the Clinical Department of Family Medicine at WITS, and so it continues. I'd just like you to see the caliber of people that were involved in assisting us with the science and the people that have real concerns about the impact, the possible impact of this application. And then we also had 22 organizations that supported our petition and 7,000 individual signatures. What we were requesting in the petition is, first of all, the overturn of the GMO Executive Council's decision to approve this commodity import. Already maize and soya has been approved, and we feel that these decisions should be overturned. We'd like to see any further imports of this variety banned. And then we'd also like to see a review of the current mechanisms for risk assessment and approval of GMO permits. And this has been our biggest issue in the last decade, is massive difficulty in getting scientific data and access to information, in being involved in the decision-making process, hearing about the decisions that have been made. And that's been a big difficulty for us, so we'd really like for that to be looked at. Just a bit of background before I go into the actual presentation on GMOs, to let you know what are the commercial GM traits that are on the market, because I think there's a lot of there's not a lot of real information about what's really out there. We've heard that GMOs are drought tolerant, have longer shelf life, they have better nutrition, they reduce pesticide use, they increase yield, and a lot of this is just media spin. When you look at the actual reality, there really are only two GM crops on the market. The one is herbicide tolerant, which basically means the farmer can plant their crop, and they can spray, they could do if they wanted an aerial spray of a herbicide. A chemical herbicide, they could do an aerial spray, and kind of everything in the field would die except for that herbicide-tolerant crop. So that constitutes around 59% of all the crops that are grown worldwide are herbicide-tolerant. Oh, I'm sorry, I have added in a few slides here if you you're missing on your following on your papers. The other crop is pest resistant, which are called BT, which means that the crop produces its own toxin and this repels certain pests. And that constitutes around 15%. And then we have stacked varieties, which is a mixture of the two. So that's what's on the market. In 2013, a drought-resistant crop was released in the USA, and we're yet to see how that performed. But that doesn't really take as a very, very new crop. And I won't go into it now, but there's a lot of discussion around whether or not that will be effective. And then which crops are modified? We also are told that GMO crops are the panacea for world hunger, that we need to grow them to feed people. So people kind of think that everything's genetically modified, but the only crops that are modified is soya. In 2011, 47% of all the crops, GM crops in the world were soya, maize, cotton, and canola. And then there's a smaller amount of alfalfa and sugar beet, mostly in the States. So those are the three crops that are growing. And although we see maize as a staple in South Africa, it's not really a staple in any of the other countries producing. It's mostly produced for animal feed, some for agri-fuels, and then industrial purposes. So in South Africa, we're unique in allowing our staple food to be genetically modified. It's not really eaten anywhere else in the world as we eat it here. And then we also get this idea that GMO crops are the norm, and if you don't get on the train and adopt GMO crops, you're missing the train and you're behind and backward. The reality, I'm sorry, this is a very bad map. It's a world map. I don't think you can see the continents. But the green dots, the bigger the dots, the more crops, GM crops are growing in that region. So the United States, these are statistics from 2011, but they haven't changed much to today. In 2011, the United States was growing 69 million hectares of GM crops. The next largest amount growing was in Brazil, 30.3 million of GM crops, and Argentina, 23.7 million. So between those three countries alone, that constitutes about 77% of all the GM crops growing in the world, with the United States leading the pack. And it's been, they came out in 1996, so it's been 16, 17 years. And really, if you look at it in this way, you can see that the uptake has been quite slow, and there's been a lot of caution around adopting them, and there's been a lot of consumer rejection of them. And you'll see Africa is pretty empty. We have South Africa at the bottom. There's a big green dot there. I think this year we grew 2.9 million hectares of GM crops. Burkina Faso has, in the last few years, started growing GM cotton. And Egypt allowed GM maize, I think, in 2009, but they yet to really start growing it because they have problems with their biosafety law. So South Africa continues to be the only country in Africa that is growing a food crop and just going ahead. And then just to reiterate again that GM crops are not being grown for human consumption. 40% of the entire world's grain production is used for animal feed, and maize and soya are massive commodity crops that are traded all over the world for animal feed, not for human feed. And again, it's South Africa that's very unique in this regard. And then just a quick look at who actually feeds the world. We tend to think that the industrial food system is supplying our food and that we need to keep on feeding the industrial agriculture and industrial food chain. But when you look at statistics, you see that peasant farmers around the world who are mostly growing without chemicals, without much support in terms of breeding of their seeds, without very much assistance at all, about 50% of our food is provided by peasant farmers. And these are people who are not ever going to be able to use GMOs. They don't have the potential to gain the capital outlay that is necessary to do that. And it's these people that continue to need support in growing crops. The industrial food chain is supplying about 30% of our food at the moment, and then urban gardening and hunting and gathering supplies the rest. So I said earlier that we have two types of crops, GM crops. We have BT, the insect resistant, and we have herbicide tolerant crops. And up until now, what we've been growing is the herbicide tolerant crops are resistant to a chemical called glyphosate. And the problem is that nature adapts. And the more we've been spraying glyphosate into the environment and onto our farms, the more weeds that grow in those fields are beginning to adapt to glyphosate, and now the glyphosate is no longer working. And this leaves a massive problem for farmers. They end up having their fields choked with huge weeds that they just can't do anything with. So they either have to start spraying older chemicals or more of the same chemicals or bringing in a lot of labor to hack out these weeds. It's a very big problem. So the idea now has been to engineer crops that are resistant to a more toxic and more controversial herbicide called 2,4-D, so that if the glyphosate doesn't work, they can spray 2,4-D onto their crops. And we really just see this as a runaway train, that of course, in time, the weeds are going to become tolerant to 2,4-D, and are we just going to keep on spraying more and more toxic chemicals onto our food? This 2,4-D crop has not actually been given approval yet anywhere in the world. It's been developed in the United States, but it hasn't yet received approval, and this is one of our big problems with our risk assessment procedure, is that our government has given the green light and has said that it's safe to import this commodity maize, but it hasn't even been given the green light in the United States to be grown. So we see that there's a big problem in our risk assessment procedure then. So as I say, our regulators have approved commodity imports of 2,4-D maize and soya already. So we're saying, yeah, sure, bring the maize into the country. We'll use it for human consumption, food, feed, and processing. We think that it's safe. Two-four-D is known from its use as a compound in Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. That's why we've kind of dubbed this the Agent Orange maize and soya. It's one component of Agent Orange, which is very notorious for the health impacts and the environmental devastation that it caused. The most visible detrimental effects on human health at that time were caused by contaminations with dioxin, which can occur as a highly toxic byproduct. Dioxin is classified as a human carcinogen and is also capable of causing reproductive problems and damaging the immune system. It is still found in some 2,4-D mixtures. When you look at the substance 2,4-D, apart from Agent Orange, academic studies show toxic effects of DNA, birth deformations, and endocrine disrupting effects. And we've listed that in our petition in detail. This chemical 2,4-D is completely banned in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. It has restricted use in Canada. And in South Africa, aerial applications have been banned in KwaZulu-Natal. And there's a total ban in the districts of Camperdown, Pietermaritzburg, and Richmond. And then in its ester form, it's completely prohibited from use in Western Cape. It's been withdrawn from agricultural use in the Western Cape. So it's not a chemical that we want to see coming into South Africa. And although we know this is just a commodity import that has currently been approved, we have seen over the years that South African regulators follow the trends in the United States, and we would expect at some point in the future to see an application for environmental release in South Africa. And we also know that in South Africa our farmers are also already battling with glyphosate-resistant weeds, so it would make sense that they might need to go on to stronger chemicals. In terms of our concerns around GMO safety in general, I've mentioned before that we're unique in allowing modification of our staple food, whereas in other places it's primarily grown for animal feed. And we always hear in the media, and the response from the biotech industry is, oh, we've been eating GMOs for 15 years with no reports of ill effects. And we just find that to be quite mischievous, because there have never been any studies carried out on the post-commercial impacts of GMOs in our nation. There's no baseline. There's been absolutely no studies. We have no idea what it is doing to people. So I don't know if what they're saying is that South Africans are healthy. I don't think that's the case. There are many sicknesses in South Africa, and we don't know if any of them are stemming from eating GMOs as a staple food. And then, of course, GMOs have never been labeled in the past 13 years. People have no idea they're eating GMOs. So if they are falling ill, how are they going to report, or how are they going to link that illness with GMOs? They don't even know that they're eating it. So in South Africa, our government has never done a single independent study on the health impacts of maize. And I can tell you from looking at all the dossiers that we've looked, that the science that's coming out of the developers of GMOs are not looking for, they're not looking for the health impact. They're going on the idea that these things are inherently as safe as conventional foods, and they're not looking for problems. And independent science is flagging a lot of problems. And what happens is that every time negative information about GMOs comes out, it just gets squashed. And we think a more reasonable response is to follow up and see what problems are actually happening. So some of the health concerns that are coming out of independent scientific studies, I've put some references there, but I mean, there's I can give you thousands of references. So to try and just group them all together, some of the worrying impacts include effects on the gastrointestinal tract, inflammations, ulcerations, and excessive growth of stomach and gut lining. Of course, our stomach is our first line defense against disease. So if that's not working properly, we're more susceptible to disease. And, of course, our stomach ensures that we have good nutrition. So it's very serious if we're having problems with the gut. Very common to see disturbances of liver, pancreas, and kidney function, disturbance of testes function, alterations in hematology. We see that the animals have altered body weight. We don't really know why that is. There needs to be more research done. Allergic reactions and immune responses and impacts on second generations. We've also seen nutritional changes, altered levels of existing or presence of new toxins, altered level of existing or presence of new allergens, anti-nutrients, which stop the body from absorbing nutrients, and altered level of existing nutrients like vitamins. So if independent science is saying that these are a problem, we don't understand why the response is always to squash it and say that the studies are rubbish. We just need to trust that GMOs are safe. We really feel it's incumbent upon our government to start carrying out our own independent tests to see that our staple food is safe. So the concerns that I've listed are about the actual GM food, the genetically modified food, but we also need to think about what are the effects of the chemicals that are sprayed onto the crops, because GM crops always come with pesticides and herbicides, and not enough information or research is being carried out on how those chemicals are impacting the workers that are exposed to the chemicals daily, and how they're impacting us when we get the residues in our food. I put this in here because in all these years I've never seen a single independent African study on the health impacts of GM foods. And this year I came across three studies that have come out of Egypt. As I said earlier, Egypt has given approval for BT maize, although they're not really growing it yet. Last year, the Suez Canal University did a feeding study with rats, and they concluded that GM maize intake had caused statistically significant impacts on the liver, kidneys, testes, spleen, and small intestine. They recommended more scientific investigation, including case-by-case and long-term studies, to make sure that GM foods won't result in health problems. Also from the Suez Canal University, a study with male rats showed several changes in organs, body weight, and serum biochemistry, and they found that this indicates potential adverse toxic effects of GM corn and recommended further investigation. And lastly, Alexandria University did a chemical analysis showing significant differences from the conventional counterpart that may be toxic to the human food and animal feed. They also suggested further long-term feeding studies are required. And this last one is also significant because it flies in the face of an idea or the notion of substantial equivalence. And our risk assessment procedure is based on a notion of substantial equivalence, which basically says that a GM crop is exactly the same as its conventional counterpart, except for the new trait that's been introduced. So when it comes to BT crops, you say that the GM variety and the non-GM are exactly the same, except one expresses a toxin that controls pests. But when you look closer, you start to see that this is not actually the case, that other things are also changing in the GM crop. It's expressing different proteins, or it's behaving differently in the environment under environmental stress. And because of this idea of substantial equivalence, our risk assessment procedures have not been rigorous enough. So I've spoken about the idea of substantial equivalence and the fact that our regulatory system rests on the idea that GMOs are inherently safe and they're exactly the same as the non-GM counterpart. And we find this to be very, very dangerous. And that this is the issue, the reason that we're not doing the correct research into the safety of these foods. When it comes to regulatory rules for pesticides or drugs, we'll see that tests are carried out for 3 months with 3 mammalian species, and then with a mammalian species for 1 year, and then another mammalian species for another 2 years. Now, this is for a drug that is going to come onto the market and be prescribed by a doctor to a patient. It's labeled, the patient knows what they're taking, they know what the side effects are, and they know who to report to if there's a problem. When it comes to putting a novel food into our food system, we have a 90-day feeding trial, which is not mandatory. It's often on birds, sometimes on rats, sometimes on fish. It's carried out by the applicant, not by any independent body. And then it's shrouded in confidential business information. This is our biggest concern when we're trying to interact with the regulatory approval system, that we can't actually see any of the data because everything just gets deleted as confidential business information. Then this goes into our food system. Nobody knows what they're eating. Nobody's following up to see the impact. And as a public, we are just expected to take it on faith that the applicants are doing the right safety testing and that our food is safe. And we just don't believe it. South African maize is saturated with GMOs. There is no alternative. For those who want to eat non-GM maize, and there are a lot of people that don't want to eat GM maize, it is impossible. There's only one stream in our country of maize. It's all kept in the same silos. It's not segregated. And now about 90% of our maize is genetically modified at the moment. In recent tests that we carried out on popular brands, Niala, Iweza, Woolies Maize Meal, Ace, White Star, Impala, and Bripup, we saw as much as 87% GM maize content. So even if we do get labeling, the labeling legislation has been stalled, but even if it is labeled in the end, it's absolutely pointless because you can read on the package that it's modified, but you can't make a different choice even if you want to. And for us, that to not be able to make a choice around your staple food, and especially one as controversial as this that has been severely restricted in other countries, we just find it unbelievable that this is the case we have in South Africa. And unfortunately, in a free market society, we're not quite sure what can be done about that. But we would like to see a separate stream of non-GMAs so that a choice can be made. And ideally, we'd like to see that being filled by smallholder farmers. Are you wanting to add something? Yeah? Okay, so I'm going to ask Gareth to just speak to you a little about the pesticides and GM crops.
Good morning. Thank you again for the opportunity. Can everyone hear me? Okay.
I can only indicate to you that you started at 20 after 9. Mm-hmm. So in between that, we have an hour all together with questions with yourself.
Oh, with questions.
Okay, I'll be as brief as possible. Thank you. As Heidi mentioned before, the vast majority of crops grown, GM crops grown worldwide, are modified to be tolerant to herbicides. And it's interesting to note the largest seed companies operating globally, sort of Monsanto, Pioneer, Hybrid, are actually owned by DuPont. They're chemical companies, DuPont. Are a chemical company. Originally, Monsanto made chemicals long before they went into seeds, and Syngenta, that came out of a pharmaceutical merger. So those 2011 figures, you can see 85% of the GM crops planted worldwide had the herbicide-tolerant trait. That was either a single, what they'd call a single-stack herbicide-tolerant plant, or a stacked event with insect resistance as well. Some research carried out from the US a couple of years ago by Charles Benbrook, and you can see there the herbicide-tolerant crops, in his estimation, have been responsible for an overall increase in pesticide use. When he says an overall increase, that means taking into account the reductions that the insect-resistant crops have sort of resulted in decreased insecticide use, but the overall pesticide use sort of skyrocketed by, well, you can see there, it's nearly 240,000 metric tons. In South America now, they're growing nearly 50 million hectares of Roundup Ready soya. And when it was first approved in Argentina, that was the first approval in South America, that area was around 17 million hectares in the whole continent. You can see there's been a huge increase there, and likewise the use of glyphosate in Argentina, as you can see there, increased 11-fold. Brazil is now the world's largest pesticide market, and the sales increased by 360% in the first decade of the new millennium. In Bolivia, where they're also growing HT, herbicide-tolerant soybean, you can see glyphosate use has increased by a factor of 3.5, but also other pesticides as well, 2,4-D, atrazine, paraquat, they've all increased as well. And if you go to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's website, they list the current applications pending for approval, and 8 of the 13 crops currently awaiting approval. Again, they're all for herbicide-tolerant crops, and they're for all these new herbicides based on new active ingredients, as my colleague alluded to earlier. In South Africa, we're sort of echoing this very much. There's been a big increase in the area planted to herbicide-tolerant crops, both in maize and also soybean. And people in the soybean industry are predicting by the end of this decade we could be growing up to 1 million hectares of Roundup Ready soya. And over sort of this period, the annual use of glyphosate in South Africa has increased dramatically as well. You can see there from 12 to 20 million litres annually. Now, in 2012, we had some food products tested for glyphosate residues, though we had to send these products to France because we couldn't find a local laboratory that could test for glyphosate. Some further research, we noted very limited capacity for monitoring pesticide residues in our domestic food supply. The export markets were predominantly fruit, and they had better capacity, but as far as domestic capacity was concerned, it was quite low. You can see there, again, these figures are a couple of years old, but I suspect they'd be similar now. Only 11 food inspectors on the Health Professions Council of South Africa on their sort of lists. We were assured by the Department of Health that they would initiate a trial run for testing for glyphosate residues in maize and soy meal last year, and we're not sure quite what's happening with that. And against all of this, towards the end of 2012, in South Africa, the first glufosinate-tolerant GM maize variety was approved. There are several other varieties that are glufosinate tolerant in the pipeline as well. And glufosinate is actually to be phased out in the EU, for example, by 2017 due to concerns over health. I know we're here on biosafety regulation, but we just want to bring up some severe issues we came across when trying to engage in the pesticide regulations in South Africa. There is currently a plan to overhaul the legislation because it dates from 1947, and indeed a pesticide management plan published by the Department of Agriculture acknowledges this, and that there are several shortcomings in the current legislation, including sort of protection of health, vulnerable populations, access to information, and public participation. And these issues, as Heidi has explained previously, also apply, we feel, to the GMO regulatory system as well. And we spent the best part of 2012 trying to access information on the status of the pesticide legislation, what was happening with that, and we were unable to garner any information at all from the department. We also applied for the toxicology data for glyphosate, which has to be submitted to the department in order for it to be approved, and we were informed that the department no longer had this information. They'd handed it back to the applicant, which in this case was Monsanto. In 2012, also the South African National Biodiversity Institute, they initiated an environmental monitoring project into herbicide-tolerant or glyphosate-tolerant crops, to be specific, but currently that's been stalled. There's nothing really going on with that. I was at the first meeting for this process, and it was very clear from there that the biotechnology industry, they wanted to keep any assessment of the actual chemical glyphosate out of this assessment of herbicide tolerant crops, out of this monitoring program, and we find this very bizarre, as the whole rationale for herbicide tolerant crops is to use them in conjunction with herbicides. So, and that's again in our regulatory system for GMO crops. There's very little coverage given to the impacts of the chemicals, the herbicides themselves, and that's a common problem globally, not just here in South Africa.
That's literally 1 minute.
Can I have 1 minute left? 1 minute left. Okay, well then I'll quickly... I'll just go quickly to this. I want to show you how frustrated we are in trying to engage with our risk assessment procedure. I'm busy working on this application now for general release of a variety called TC1507 by NK603 maize, which is due on the 28th. And this is from page 12, where the applicant Pioneer is asked to provide a scientific summary of the field performance of the GM field trials that were held in 2011 and 2012. And you can see at the bottom of the screen, it just says CBI deleted. So the entire result of their field trial, they've decided not to make available to us, and we can't see any reason why they would do that. And this is common. Every time you look into a dossier, everything is just CBI deleted. We find this completely unacceptable. We can't engage meaningfully in this kind of environment. Problems with the risk assessment, there's no peer-reviewed science being used. They're relying on data from the producers. It's based on substantial equivalence. There's a fair amount of rubber stamping. For example, we've given commodity clearance for this 2,4-D resistant crop before it's been cleared as safe in the United States. And our capacity for monitoring and research is lagging behind. We've only managed one study in 13 years. Sandy has done a study on a variety called MON810, and we don't know if any of those recommendations have been taken up. So basically, this is just self-regulation for the biotech industry with very little oversight. And very lastly, I just want to tell you that The ACB is not a scientific organization. That's not where our heart and soul is. We're a social justice organization. And when we look at GMOs, and we've had them for 13 years, we want to know, is it actually bringing food security? And we don't see that it is. We have at the moment about 16 million people going to bed hungry every night, despite the fact that we've had maize surpluses of about 6 million tons over the last few seasons, and we still have people going to bed hungry. And then if we look at the maize chain, starting from seed all the way to milling and distribution, there's just 10 companies that are involved in the production of our staple food. So when it comes to seed, we see Pioneer and Monsanto. When it comes to grain traders, it's just Louis Dreyfus and Cargill. When it comes to handling and storage, just three organizations. And when it comes to milling, Tiger Brands, Pioneer Foods, and Premier Foods. And the problem we see here is that there's no space for small players to be involved in this chain anywhere. It's impossible if you're a small miller, a smallholder farmer, you have a Spaza shop, you've got to compete against Woolworths, Spar, Checkers, ShopRite. The whole chain is the only players that can be involved are these small group of people. And it's not actually increasing food security. The price of maize meal has jumped by, is it 86%?
On that note...
I'd like to leave it there.
On that jump note.
Thank you.
Let's open up for engagement. Welcome, Mr. Abraham. We were informed that you had fallen ill. I hope you're better now. Thank you, sir. Members, we have in our midst also members from the department, simply just by way of raising hands, those from Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, and then those from Science and Technology, and those from Department of Health, and those from Department of Environment. So we have such a multiplicity of departments, and the simple reason is that once we engage in a matter of this nature, we tend to throw our net wide so that we have everybody who matters on such an issue with us here. The issues are very straightforward. Whilst they may be scientific, all the terminology is being used. Divided into three, and the recommendations are very straightforward. Overturn the GMO Executive Council decision in importing of those 2,4-D resistant maize and soya. It says ban further imports of such. It says review current mechanisms for risk assessment and approval of the GM permits, including public participation in decision-making. The recommendation also further mentions the fact that insofar as pesticide legislation, we go back as far as 1947, wherein such a legislation has been in place. No review of such. And the last point being raised is that there hasn't been any labeling. Labeling continues to be one of our pet subjects in this committee. Precisely because we want to know, to an extent, you protect the consumer. The consumer must have the ultimate in saying to himself, herself, I am consciously taking this decision that I am going to be buying this commodity because of whatever is contained in that label. We've just heard the other day here presentation on food safety and labeling. Started off as meat. It ended up being a food-wide issue. And labeling equally came in quite hard in that process. And again, even there, we had to pull together a variety of departments. Trade and industry, health, and also agriculture, forestry, and fisheries, to look into food safety and food labeling issues. So in summary, the rest being explained in those scientific terms and the researches that have been taking place, the summary from where I am seated. Members, that's the straightforward presentation with a very clear recommendations from the team. Ms. Abra? Mrs. Stein, Mrs.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I listened attentively to the presentation. I want to thank the presenters. In a democracy, it is important that organizations who have a concern with any specific issue do come and make their concerns known. However, Chairperson, I think one needs to accept certain issues. Firstly, you need to accept that the population increases. The hectareage of land that you can put into use diminishes to a variety of factors. For example, urban encroachment, all sorts of things. The population needs to be fed. And as we sit here, I think the good lady mentioned that 90% of the maize produced in our country, staple food in our country, is genetically modified. Now, I'm 73, and I cannot live without pup and sour milk at least twice a week. I accept that I'm eating genetically modified food. Apart from being diabetic, which sometimes puts me off gear, I haven't had any other symptoms. I haven't had any other problems. Now, the concerns, Chairperson, that have been raised could be valid. It is good that civil society organizations do keep all of us on our toes. But what is important, Chair, is the statement made here that the monitoring and research capacity in our country is lagging. And what one needs to do very, very urgently, Chair, is to see that those departments of state, and they're all here that are concerned with the issue on the table, do their job. And that if you wish to access information, assistance, whatever, that those departments are able to assist you, that they are able to put forward the information that is required. We have, for example, in our country, the Agricultural Research Council. If that council does not have the capacity to carry out the sort of research that is required in terms of the production of GMO material, plant material, then it means that the state has to make that capacity available. Throwing money alone is not the issue. that is necessary, but at the same time, we need to see that we have the researchers to do that kind of work. Other issue that was raised, Chair, was that there is no space for small millers, and it is the big three or two or four or whatever. I can assure you that I have seen in many of the rural towns, especially those where maize is being produced, where small millers do provide a service. Now, Chairperson, what may be necessary again is that the Department of Agriculture in this case should have a dedicated team that should seriously look at how it can empower small growers or a group of small growers in various parts of the mealie-producing belt, which this year has shrunk substantially because of drought, and assist those people to, on the one hand, become entrepreneurs, adding value to their produce, and on the other hand, to provide for the needs of local communities. One hopes at lower overheads, they don't have big boards which take up quite a chunk, that such small companies or small millers will be able to make available that product to the end user at a sustainable price, a reasonable price. That sort of approach would be proactive, and it would also create new entrepreneurs. Finally, Chairperson, the issue of pesticides. In my experience, you cannot live without pesticides when you are farming. You have questions of wat is onkruid nou weer, weeds. You've got to control weeds. Otherwise, they overgrow and your mealie plant is gone. I've seen it happen. You need to see that certain wood borers, stalk borers, and that sort of stuff are controlled. At the end of the day, one must accept that nobody is in farming because they want to make food available cheap to somebody. They must make a profit. They must live out of it. They've got to take the necessary steps to see that their crop, the anticipated crop, is one that can sustain them. Remember, they also provide substantial employment. They've got to pay taxes. The farmer in this country is exposed to 12 different forms of taxes, and now with the e-tolls and all the nonsense that goes along with it, the number of forms of taxation increases. So one has to take a global view, Chair, and as far as the major concern is concerned, I reiterate, we have to beef up that capacity. If it is poorly resourced, we've got to find it. We've had some excellent scientists in our country. We need to see that we create that kind of capacity. And we need to see that at the end of the day, what comes on the table of the consumer must be safe, reasonably safe, to consume. Thank you, Chair.
Are you part of the media? I'm not sure about you recording. I know members from the media are given whatever accreditations. And we have PMG here also that does all the recordings. Mrs. T?
thank you, Chairperson. I also want to thank the presentation, the presenters for coming to make this presentation to us. We really appreciate this. Chair, I want to just quickly go to what my colleague, Honourable Abram said then, and you also mentioned it, Chair. I think one of the, just as a main point for all the departments, one of our concerns is all these things that we discussed when we had the meeting, the regular things about regulations, about things like monitoring, who is supposed to be doing the monitoring, and also the labeling issues that I actually said last time, you know, just to put up the label I don't think is going to fix the problem, because to have a label and you can't monitor it and people don't have the capacity to go and look at it and test it then at the end of the day, and also giving the different quantities and things like that up to label it is not going to end the issue or the problem at the end of the day. So I don't think the labeling itself is the biggest challenge, Chair. Chairperson, I'm really concerned about some of the information that I received today. The first thing is that we don't do really research and that the research is not made available. That really concerns me. My first question would be, who sits on this body that look at the GMO regulations, which department specifically, and if there are any non-departmental people, and who are they, so that we at least know that body, who they are, and so on. And do they have the information? Obviously, they must have all the information at hand as soon as an application is made. Do they look at it and on all that kind of thing? So I would like to start there, Chairperson. The second thing that I'm also concerned about is that this 2,4-D was banned in 1991. I see here in Natal, and then I can't remember the ban in the Western Cape, what the date was. I would have liked to know from the department what the reasons for that ban was at that stage, and why you can now import the crop if there was a ban in certain areas, and how do you now monitor again as a department? Obviously, you know, if there's a ban for the pesticide in those areas, you won't allow the farmers then to plant the seeds in that specific area. So how does the monitoring then happen? And the control of that, and then just as I said, for ourselves, why the ban was taking place in the first place those many years ago, and it hasn't been lifted as far as I know, and what the reasons is that it wasn't lifted, and why is it only in those specific areas? I think I would just like to start there. Thank you, Chair.
Mama?
Chairperson? Thank you, and I want to also to thank the presenters. Really, we thank you, because it's like South Africa, we are confused when coming to these GMOs. Others will say it is a good thing. Others will say it is not. And here we have the AR and the OP, the OPP, and other researchers groups. Why maybe the department concerned, health department, agriculture, and in that line, why are not they worried about these things? And another worry, my worry, is that it says South Africa is being the only country in Africa which grows the GMOs. And they are saying in other countries, the maize and the soya is for animal feed. And in South Africa and other countries, maybe in Africa, in particular, these are our food, And we don't know really what we are eating, since the labeling, even that, even though it's not the, the solution, the labeling. But I think the labeling is very important. So that I was looking at the stage what, the all kind of maize. Here I am eating star, white star. And I can see the percentage there. Now, if the labeling was monitored and being put in place, so that we must know what we are eating. It's just the same like we were talking last week when we were talking about the meat, the labeling, and all these things. And here in South Africa, majority we have poor people who are living in the rural areas. Maize is our staple food, and we want it. We can't live without it. But since we have this problem, which other countries have banned it, and in South Africa, we say it's good for us. We don't know how long it takes for us to be ill, but a little bit concern, which we are seeing all over South Africa, a little bit concern, is with the growing generation. You know, what we see today in the growing youth generation is not what was there when we grew up. And look at this young people today. I don't know. I'm not saying it's because of this, but there is something wrong. There is something wrong which needs to be researched. You know, all the young girls cannot have, you know, this terms, these things here, and, you know, stomach falling and all these things. You know, they can't, it can't be. And we say it's good, you know, maybe it's democracy, it's freedom, it's all this. No, there is something wrong. There is something wrong, which we need the researchers to go down and find out what is the cost. And in my mind, I'm saying this cost is from the food, but we don't know which food, but this cost is from the food. I was once a youngster, a young girl. I never grew such. No. Because that time we eat things from the field. No, nothing. And we were, you know, 100% okay. But generation of today, there is no guarantee. And again, Chairperson, another worry which I have is when you don't have a choice. You see, when you don't have a choice, always we will get sick. As for me, I have allergy. I don't know what brings this allergy. I go to the doctors, I have allergy. And I live with allergics always because I must scratch myself. But there is something which brought this allergy. And I keep on eating because I don't know what brought it. And I keep on eating and I keep on having it. I keep on scratching. I will take the tablet. If I don't take for a week, I'll continue scratching. Yeah, really, department, let us be serious, because otherwise our generation, our youth, they will not live to see maybe 8 years, 90 years, or upwards, if we are not careful. You know, others, they can say it's good, But if they don't agree, other researchers are saying it's not good. Others, they are saying it's good. No, we should bring these people together. They must research and tell us the way forward. And another way forward for us, Chairperson, I don't know if we still have that time, is to do the public hearings in all the provinces about these GMOs. And we must hear from people what are they thinking about this thing. It's killing us or it's giving us long life. Thank you, Chairperson.
There's a bit of a challenge. You had indicated that you wanted to be excused around 11 thereabout. To an extent, ideally, the departments would have come in almost at the tail end. But now, that shall miss some of the areas the department might wish to have punched in some holes. To an extent, we would have, I think it would have been a lot more appropriate, even before we engage ourselves, that we get a sense from the department of any comments without getting into any discussion per se. Bearing in mind that you did come before us as a department and briefed us on the matters we are about. That's what I wanted us to deal with, so that we are also guided going forward. Otherwise, some of the areas, to give you but one example, I did ask directly a specific question as to whether are we indeed importing what you call the dose 2, 4.1 element. I think it's a chemical within that resistant maize and soya, all right? And I got a response that was directly saying, no, there is no importation. Those are the kinds of comments I would have wanted to the department, you know, to come through with, so that we don't, within a space of 10 minutes, can we just allow that? Maybe in the next presentation as well, so that we have one composite presentation, if you like, which then sets a process for us to engage in. I think let's engage. Let's give the departments that opportunity. You know, 2 minutes each on the areas without giving any preambles to the point. Let's start off with DAF. The other point I forgot to mention, we also did have Mrs. Dudley from ACDP. By the time I checked, she is, I'm sure she should be coming back. She's from the ACDP. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members and colleagues. Just from DAF's side, one point of clarity. The request for approval was, in fact, for commodity clearance. That means it's for food and feed purposes. The confusion that also persists in the presentation is that that there has been imports, whilst there's also a statement that it's not approved anywhere in the world. And if it's not approved anywhere in the world, then there could not have been any imports, because that means that it's not grown anywhere legally. I can confirm that at this point there has not been any imports. However, there has been approvals in other countries for use as food and feed. So it's just important that, and we would be happy to share that information, but it's important that we have that clarity. Then in terms of the regulatory system, it is our view that the regulatory system is robust, sufficiently robust, which includes scientists of various disciplines, and this does represent a mechanism of peer review of the information on risk assessment data, which the regulatory system considers in coming to their decision. There's a number of articles or literature that was cited, but I think it would be irresponsible also not to indicate that some of these are in fact linked to other studies which have in the meantime been retracted because of the concerns around the scientific merit of those studies. In terms, the Act does provide for the review of any decision as and when new information does become available. And in fact, with the last study where there was concern about the carcinogenicity of a specific GMO, that is in fact what our regulatory system undertook. However, we did find also that what was presented by the scientist was not of sufficient scientific merit. And I will rest there, Chair. Thank you.
Any comments from other departments? Help?
Thank you, Chair. Just to respond to the question that was raised that the Department of Health was going to run a sample, was going to do a sample run 2012-2013 on glyphosate. Yes, that was done. And all the samples that were tested were within the maximum residue level of 2 milligrams per kilogram as put in the regulation R246 of 11 February 1994. And to go further, when we were last here, we were advised by the DTI that there's a draft regulation that is aiming to bring in enforcement of mandatory labeling of all foods containing GM ingredients. It's still in draft, Chair. So, but there was that was mentioned as well, which would take care of labeling concerns probably. Thank you.
Perhaps, Chair, just to respond to the question Honorable Stein asked who sits on the council. There are four departments that are here, including DTI, are sitting on the council.
Are we fine with the rest of the other departments? No relevant information? Okay, thank you.
From the Department of Science and Technology, I just want to support what our colleague has said from the Department of Agriculture. And when they go actually through the GMO applications, a very rigorous process is being followed. And we do also get experts in when there's not, when we need clarity on specific issues. So I think we're quite confident with the process that's been followed up to now. Thank you.
Another reality, members, that we need to be alive to is the fact that this process is going to be an ongoing one. As part of our legacy report that we shall have to leave behind, as we are almost nearing the end of our term, we shall obviously have to recommend to the incoming committee that, among others, this area has to be taken forward. So that we have clarity, I would imagine, at the back of our minds. Others are thinking as to what then happens, because we're almost at the tail end of our term. So just to give clarity to that effect. Members, that then sums up the responses, and hopefully that clarifies some of the issues that have been raised, and especially also I'm equally quite conscious of the fact that easily we can get into a dialogue. In other words, expected of the presenters to respond to what has been said by some of the officials from the departments. And that's quite natural. Members, are we fine with the rest? And then perhaps maybe we want to allow the presenters to respond?
In terms of the commodity imports of 2,4-D, we are in agreement that there have not been any commodity imports. As you say, it's impossible to have commodity imports because it's not growing anywhere in the world. Our concern is how has our regulatory system allowed to say, yes, you can import this variety, it's safe, when the USDA has not declared it safe? So for us, there's a missing link somehow. Somehow the information that they were basing their decision on is different from what's happening in the United States. This is our problem. We can see that, are they just rubber stamping anything that comes before them? How did this happen, that it was approved? And then it's been stalled in the United States, the approval, because they said they needed further safety studies. So it's been stalled for a year and a half now, I think, pending further safety studies. So there's a gap there in our risk assessment procedure, and it's difficult for us to understand what it is because we battle to access information. We also don't know who is on the advisory council. The GMO Executive Council is made up of 10 or 11 departmental bodies, and we know who's on that board. But then there's an advisory council who are scientists, and they're the ones who advise the Executive Council. And we've applied for the names of those people, and we're not allowed to know who they are. That's confidential business information. So for us, there's a lack of transparency going on in the risk assessment procedure and approval procedure.
Just on that one, advisory council members.
It's the advisory committee. That those are the body of scientists that advises the council chair.
Mm. Do we have the names?
The names are available, and we've received the request. We've gone through a process of obtaining a legal opinion, and the legal opinion was that them performing an advisory function, their name should not be divulged, just to maintain the independence of those scientists.
You can continue. We'll come back.
Then in terms of the retracted study, I wasn't that study is the Seralini study with the very sensational pictures of the rats. Yes, that has been retracted. None of the citations I had in my presentation were from that study. But my comment on that is that the advisory board, the executive council, agreed that the study had no merit and that we shouldn't take it into account. And this was for a variety of maize called NK603, which we do consume in South Africa. We applied for Monsanto's scientific data, which they gave to the Executive Council in 2008, and the Council approved that variety based on Monsanto's data. We got 2 pages back from them. There was no information about the kinds of rats used, the length of the study, what diets they were fed. If you want to compare the science, Monsanto science, with Seralini's science, you'll go for Seralini any day. So if you want to retract Seralini's study, then you must relook at Monsanto's study, which is what we are using to make decisions. And so we see there's some double standards there. Yeah?
Just to add to what's already been said, I mean, quickly, in the wake of the Seralini study, the European Union did actually decide, although the study was discredited in Europe, they decided that there was a need for long-term health studies, and the European Union is currently in the process of putting together a long-term feeding study. And the French Academies of Science, they've all agreed, no matter what the relative merits or otherwise of the study, there is a big gap in the risk assessment, and they have decided to take that up and conduct their own studies. Going back to the 2,4-D tolerant varieties, just if I can bring up the example of the Norwegian risk assessment procedure, this variety, I believe it was for the soybean variety as well, went up before the Norwegian biosafety assessment team. Now, in Norway, they take into account sort of socio-economic considerations in their risk assessment process. And because, as we saw earlier, 2,4-D is banned for use in Norway, they refused the to approve it for import into Norway because this crop would encourage the use of 2,4-D in other countries where it was being grown. So I think that would be an interesting thing to look at here, especially given the bans and partial bans in some parts of South Africa.
We are 10 minutes after our deadline. Are we still continuing? Are you fine?
I just had one more point, if I may.
And
that's around the labeling.
In less than a minute.
Yes, less than a minute. I think on the labeling issue, I do agree that it's important to have labeling because it's a consumer's right to know. But I think what needs to go with that is consumer education, because people don't understand the debate around GMOs. And then, of course, we have to have choice. So if people are it's going to be on there, we need a mechanism to ensure that, for example, honourable member who says she's got allergies, if she wants to try eating non-GMAs and see if it helps her allergies, that needs to be available for her. And at the moment, it doesn't exist on the market. So those are just
What becomes the price differential between GM and... I'm aware that you have GM, you have non-GM, you have organic.
There is a premium at the moment for non-GM maize. I think there's about 20%. I know SAB procures non-GM maize, and there are a few GM-free zones in the country, and they do get a premium for that. The price would, in the current system, the price would definitely jump, and I can't give you an answer on what that would be. The whole system is so monolithic at the moment that...
Talk about organic.
Organic, the price differential is just ridiculous. You pay like 20 rand for a little thing like this of organic maize, and when you cook it, it's horrendous. So there's a whole structural readjustment that needs
to happen. Is there a market in South Africa?
For non-GM, for GM-free maize? Yes, definitely there is.
For organic and for non-GM. And how big is that if you were to compare? In the event where people have a choice, consciously saying, I am now going to X retail store to get organic, to get non-GM.
I would say the organic market is teeny, teeny, tiny. But the non-GMA, there definitely is a very big market for that. And and especially the more people are educated, the more people want it. And we've just heard recently that, like from Zimbabwe, there was a huge tender given to South African farmers, I think from the Zimbabwean government, did you see that? For non-GMAs, and they couldn't fulfill that. In South Africa, they couldn't fulfill that tender for non-GMAs. So we've got markets outside of the country, definitely in SADC, our trading partners, huge markets, our European trading markets. And what I was saying earlier is that we see that as a massive opportunity for smallholder farmers to fulfill the GM-free market. And we'd love to see government support to assist them to fill that gap.
Okay, thanks for that, Ms. Swanby. Thanks for that. That assists us going forward. And as I said, it is certainly work in progress. One of our responsibilities here is to open that platform for that dialogue. So this is one of those. Without waste of time, we shall then have to move straight and fast to the agri-biotech industry. Whilst you are busy, we can just, you know, stretch our legs for 5 minutes. Thanks. You're more than welcome to listen to the next presentation.
name of the woman that presented?
Are you doing well?
Sweden, something like that. I'm not sure.
Okay, please, do you know the name of the woman that spoke from there? Doctor. From the Department of Health.
Supposed to get some lessons. But